Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's a gorgeous day here in Wolverhampton. It's very, very sunny, low wind. The birds are very, very happy. And today's podcast is inspired by quite a long conversation I'm having with my pals on Facebook concerning control. So we thought that it'd be interesting to do a podcast entitled, Are We in Control? So we just had a quick look at the various definitions. Definition of control: to direct the behaviour of a person or animal, to cause a person or animal to do what you want, to have power over something or someone, to direct the actions or function of something or someone, or to cause something or someone to act or function in a certain way. That's one of the definitions that we've got there.
Yeah, I think that captures the ordinary usage of the term, I think, more or less. I think if you're going to talk about control, you do automatically have to think about power.
Yeah.
You know, in that definition, the power to make somebody or something do what you want. I think we also have to consider desire, probably. You notice that phrase there, to do what you want.
Yes.
To do what you want.
It's like
to do
cause, want, power, direct, all those words are
and
in there.
And obviously, I think then we have the notion of causality. Because A cannot be said to be in control of B unless there's some kind of causal connection between the intention or the desire of A and the behaviour of B. Without causality, you can't talk about control. So we're automatically assuming that causality applies in the universe. And this is something we're hardwired to take for granted. But it's not something that we can prove actually is going on. We don't have the God's eye view or the Olympian perspective on everything to categorically state that causality applies. Now, a lot of people think that science proves causality. Science doesn't prove causality. Science assumes causality or presupposes causality in order to function. As do we, you know. Strange bedfellows, Kant and Nietzsche both thought that causality is provided by us. You know, it's the schema which we apply to our raw data in order to understand the world. It's a part of that schema. So, metaphysically speaking, the idea of control is a bit suspect, even though, of course, in everyday life and in our lived experience, we can't deny that it exists. We exert control over all kinds of things, day in and day out, probably moment to moment. You know.
Yeah.
So we've got this kind of conundrum, you know, that metaphysically we're on the ground of deep uncertainty. And in terms of our lived experience, we have to live with the notion that we can't throw off, even if we would like to. I mean, another thing that we need to say about it before we kind of dig in is that at least three distinct but overlapping universes of discourse in which control is a conceptual feature that we could, if we wanted to get really diverted, discuss, unpack, deconstruct, whatever, in an attempt to get some sort of understanding. I mean, for instance, you know, the question, are we in control? What do you mean by we? Before we start about control, do you mean by we? You know, is this a question that's being asked on the individual level, which I suspect is what the discussion you've been having is about? But is this a question about the collective level? Or in that kind of general universal level? Is the human species in any measure in control? You know, is our society in control of itself? or of other societies, or of the world, or of resources, or of the climate, or whatever. Yeah? So there's at least two views. I mean, that's how there is an individual approach to this, and I think this is the one that we're going to take.
Yeah. But when we were talking about it yesterday, it was revealed to be a absolutely massive topic, wasn't it, really?
Yeah, but then there's the huge question on the level of culture, social organisation, society, you know, the human world, you might want to call it. As to what degree control the human beings through their processes of government and decision making and all the rest of it. Is there any control in that sphere? Is there any ability to make things happen, to exert power, to bring about desired outcomes in the course of events? Is there? And if so, what is its nature? And is it desirable? And if we haven't got it, how can we have it if we were to think it was desirable? Etc. Huge problems. Huge analysis awaiting us on that front. And another way of looking at it, which we've just touched upon actually, is to consider it just under the rubric of metaphysics. You know, it's to think, is there any control at all in the cosmos? In other words, does determinism apply or not? Yeah. Or is the universe indeterminate, as quantum physics seems to suggest, since we have to use mathematics of probability rather than a Newtonian mathematics of true equations, you know, where the left-hand side does actually really equal the right-hand side. So it's kind of a deterministic physics as opposed to a probabilistic physics. So there's like huge questions there, and I think it's a popular one for getting philosophy undergraduates to kind of cut their teeth on something that really hurts your brain.
Yeah.
You know, determinism stroke free will. Do we have free will? Or does determinism apply throughout the universe? Well, of course, you know, if we don't have free will, we can't control anything, because there are no real decisions. If the universe is completely determined, in other words, there are absolutely ineluctable chains of cause and effect from the beginning of time till the end of time, which are never ever ruptured by anything, then in that case, no creature has free will.
Okay.
Right. And human beings don't have free will, however much they feel they've got it. Now, some kind of like spiritual wallahs take a kind of a line like this. They try and get into a cosmic proof of determinism, so that they can then say that, well, any free will that you think you had is an illusion. And somebody like Ramesh Balsekar seems to push a line like that. And I kind of think it's a bit... Some people get excited about that. I personally don't, because... it strikes me that we don't have the Olympian perspective to determine once and for all that determinism applies across the board forever without ever a break in any of those causal chains. You know, a decision break, yeah? Strikes me that we don't have the perspective to really absolutely know that. Number one. Number two objection is that, well, even if it is the case that there is in reality no free will, and our feeling that we have free will, our phenomenologically verifiable lived experience tells us that we do have free will, because in a minute we're going to decide whether to turn left or carry on and stuff like that.
Yeah.
We will make a decision. It's there in our lived experience. The idea that we have a choice to go left or to go right at this junction.
Yeah.
And that is real. We live with it as though it's real. And even if really all that's happening there is that we're having an epiphenomenal illusion, you know, we're imagining that we're making a choice, but actually that whole kind of scenario of imagination and belief that we have a choice between going left and right is simply produced by chains of cause and effect back from the beginning of time. And
see what you mean about the brain pain.
Yeah. This is why sadistic lecturers do this to young undergraduates. But what I'm saying is, it makes no fucking difference. It makes no difference, you know. And that Ramesh Balsekar and alloyed people's notion that since everything's determined, just don't bother to decide anything.
Right.
You know. Relax. Well, fair enough. Well, just relax. You know, cut out the fucking the metaphysical middleman. Just relax. You know.
I like that. Yeah. The metaphysical middleman.
Yeah. No, yeah. So what I'm saying there is that if the universe actually, but whatever the metaphysical situation in the universe, which is not ours to see, we can speculate about it, and I dare say we will continue to speculate about it until our species goes extinct. But it makes absolutely no difference to our lived experience, of which a feature is that we make decisions and that we choose and we exert control. That control might be illusory. Who knows? If it is or it isn't, makes absolutely no difference.
No, not really.
To the facts of lived experience of human beings.
Yeah.
So that's what I want to do with that kind of approach, you know? I mean, Nietzsche put this vis-a-vis causality, space and time, the idea that there's a doer for every deed, a thinking of every thought, a feeler of every emotion. The notion that over and against every subject there is an object, and over against every object there is a subject. This kind of, all these everyday metaphysical presuppositions, according to Nietzsche, are a schema that we just cannot throw off. It's provided by us. That's the way our brains organise the world. Our world, not the world, our world, the world we are, is organised around a handful of metaphysical notions that form common sense, the metaphysics of common sense. And Nietzsche had this nice way, he says, we have to live according to a schema which we cannot throw off. So, we have to live with the illusion of control, and maybe it isn't an illusion. Who knows? But we have to live with it.
Yeah.
We have to live with it. Now, I suspect that the question that you're asked and the discussion you're having is in the context...
Because I am having this with yoga people.
It's in the context of notions about meditation and also creativity as well.
Yeah.
So in that context, there is a big issue. And it's to do with the fact that the second aphorism of the Yoga Sutra 1.2, which I kind of translate as, yoga is when the power of repetitive patterns of thought, feeling and behaviour over us, over our destiny, you know, over our capacity for ecstasy, is attenuated. Yes, you know, it's when the power of the whirlpools in our mind over us is diminished or even evaporated.
Dissolved,
whatever. So, I mean, this is the famous Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodha. And if you look in Salvatore Zambito's collection of translations, in his big book, what's it called? The Unadorned Thread of Yoga, or something like that. Anyway, it's a book which collates a dozen translations of the Yoga Sutra, places them side by side so we can see what various pundits have made of them. And that aphorism which I've just mentioned is more often than not, I think in about 9 or 10 of these, a dozen translations, is Gloucester's been about control. I say, yoga is the subjugation of fluctuations in the mind. Yoga is the inhibition of thought. Yoga is the control. The word control comes again and again and again. Yoga is the control of the mind, you know. And there's this idea. It's kind of fairly prevalent. Now, I mean, yoga, the yoga being state, which the word yoga in this first and second aphorisms refers to the being state, rather than to the things that we do. First confusion. If you think it refers to the things that we are supposed to do, the practices of yoga, yoga is practice, then you could be forgiven for thinking that, well, yoga means that we have to do this thing, which is control our minds, which is actually make our minds stop jumping around, to stop thought, to stop mental activity. And this is what a lot of people think, and it's because they don't realise that Patanjali is talking about the yoga being state with the word yoga. And he's saying, yeah, the yoga being state, this state of beatitude and completeness and enlightenment, comes about or is present where the whirlpools in the mind stuff are not. Yeah, this is a kind of completely different way of looking at it. Yeah. Now, I actually think if you sit down in your quiet hut, in a nice place where you've got access to fresh water, where there are no plagues of insects, where there is a village nearby so that the villagers can bring you a bowl of brown rice, and you sit as prescribed in the Shiva Shamhita, the Hatha Yoga Pradipika and the Bhagavad Gita, and close your eyes and throw your attention inward in the attempt to catch a glimpse or even to become ensconced in the yoga being state. And if you then try very, very hard, as per these mistranslations of the Yoga Sutra, to control your mind, to force it to stop, to make it quiet, that this is actually a self-defeating project, and you will discover that. I actually kind of recommend to people that they try it, 10 minutes or a day or a year, but don't waste your life on it, because the actual act of attempting to control and to draw the awareness into the focus needed to exert control is itself noise. You're trying to create peace by making noise. You're trying to create silence by making noise. Makes no sense. And it doesn't actually experientially work. Try it. And this isn't what Patanjali is getting at. He's too intelligent. And a few intelligent commentators notice this. I mean, notable amongst them is the late Swami Sachinanda. Saraswati, in his translation into English of the Yoga Sutra, remarks upon this really early on. He's alert to it. Because, of course, you know, if you force too much, it just... you just create more tension. You're wanting to be relaxed and you're making yourself more tense. And I think a lot of the idiocy that spiritual seekers can be drawn into comes out of precisely this misunderstanding. And actually what one needs to do is just to let it be. Allow things to settle. Have an openness and a sensitivity and a receptivity to what's actually happening. And the mind will settle on its own. Enough for you to catch a glimpse of the yoga being state, which, as I said, is kind of beside or behind or above or around the whirlpools in the mind. Now, the whirlpools in the mind are not actually the problem. Because the whirlpools in the mind are things like memory, the ability to derive knowledge from sense perception, the ability to derive knowledge from logic, from logical inference. And these are all kind of things which are totally indispensable to human life. Potentially can't be against human life.
No.
So it's not that the vrittis that are a problem, it's the power of the vrittis that are the problem. It's our inability to step to the side into the silence, you know. I mean, and I have to keep saying to people that this is a duck-rabbit situation. And I suppose I need to explain that. What is a duck-rabbit situation?
Yeah.
Do I? Do I need to explain?
I think that probably would be a good idea.
You've probably seen like a famous drawing. Type into Google duck-rabbit and then search images and you'll see thousands of them. A figure, a simple line drawing that looks like a duck, but then it flips in front of your eyes and looks like a rabbit, and then it flips in front of your eyes and looks like a duck again. And the silence and the whirlpools in the mind are like that. A normal, lost, suffering, fragmented, neurotic state of being is one in which we see the rabbit, but not the duck. The yoga being state is one in which we see the duck and the rabbit. In other words, it's the state in which life goes on as normal and human life carries on being human life, but the yoga being state is or the quietness has flipped into the foreground and the whirlpools are flipped into the background, and in that way they're still there, available to us for the things that we need them for in practical life, but they no longer dominate, they no longer have power, you know? They are no longer in control of our destiny and of our unfolding as humans. So that's what that's about, you know. And we're not actually in control of that process. And to my mind, a highly desirable state is to know that we're in duck rabbit, in the duck rabbit condition, rather than believing that we're stuck ineluctably in rabbit. And have no notion that the duck is there.
Yeah.
The whole yoga being state is the complete thing. It's the duck and the rabbit. It's the vrittis and the silence, you know. But it's a situation in which the silence is in the foreground. Now remember, you know, there is no thought, there are no vrittis without a medium for the vrittis to happen in. Yeah? There's no writing without a page for the writing to occur upon. The blank page enables the writing. Silence enables our speech. Our speech inhabits silence. Music inhabits silence. Notes of music inhabit silence. And in that way, the silence is ever present. And so the yoga being state is something that obtains anyway. It's not a cultivation. The yoga being state isn't something that you can cultivate. You've already got it. You just need to know you got it. And that entails that gestalt switch between the duck and the rabbit. That is what happens. But the idea that control can be brought to bear in this sphere, and that we can have a program of honing the will to overcome this and that part of our being, which is deemed to be undesirable and in need of overcoming, it just doesn't work. I mean, I just say, but just try it. Just see how shitty it feels. And we keep getting told that, you know, the yoga being state is bliss, but just trying to control everything is really, really, really shitty and unnecessary and illogical. The other thing about it, of course, is now if we go back into an analysis of control itself, like a very, very sort of abstract analysis of it. Control requires a minimum of two entities. And let's say we've got entity A. And in the scenario of control, entity A is exerting power over entity B in order to make entity B behave in a manner which is now determined by entity A. Right, does that make kind of sense to me? Just
yeah,
to get it there.
Would you say, in the example of someone doing a piece of artwork, would you describe the artwork as an entity?
Yeah, the material, the medium, the paint, the paper, the water, etc. You know, but when we're talking about like the kind of self-control of ascetic yogis, you know, this kind of control that as an idea is entertained in yoga through a kind of misunderstanding of the Yoga Sutra by people who are very good at doing Sanskrit but have probably never practiced. Let's apply our abstract analysis there. Of course, what you've got is then, you're then saying, that there's one lump inside of us, one kind of part of us, one sub-personality inside of us that then controls the rest, that acts as a centre of will in order to control, in other words, to determine the behaviour of the rest. You know, in this kind of in this ascetic yoga scenario, this means that there's some sort of entity inside, some will, some centre of will, that then makes the rest shut up, you know, quiet, come into quiescence, to stop doing what it does. Now, is that realistic, you know? I mean, for a start, metaphysically, are there really such things as watertight entities, you know, Democritean atoms, if you like?
Yeah.
Well, there aren't, are there? I mean, I suppose the insight of the Buddha is that there aren't such things, you know. Nothing has inherent existence. Everything exists in relationship to everything else. You know, so our entity A, which is supposed to be controlling all these other aspects of our personality, is itself not actually truly an entity, but something which is acted upon through dependent origination with thousands and thousands of other entities, so-called, all acting upon it. Yeah? And it probably acting upon them. In other words, there is no entity existing in sufficient isolation to act as a centre of will inside the human personality to actually control, in the true sense, to exert power unequivocally over the rest of one's being. Now, the problem with that, I mean, for a start, you say it's incoherent, just doesn't actually make sense, doesn't fit in with how things work. It's a fantasy. It's a fucking pure abstraction. It's a reduction. All this talk about control and self-control is a reductionism. I mean, the way I kind of, in my crude and council estate fashion, try to shock people out of getting involved in this idiocy is to say, well, nothing's in control. Or, if you like, you've got this notion of a controller. Who controls the controller? First of all, are you even sure you've got a controller? Is there some part of you that you can inhabit that is capable of control? Is it isolated enough from everything else to actually really genuinely control? If anything else influences that entity, there is no longer true control. The idea of control does entail a unique point of inviolable will that can then exert its will outwards onto other entities. So, I mean, I say to people, you know, well, who controls the controller? I say, well, something else, some other entity. And we can get into an infinite regress there.
Yeah.
And because every time they say, oh, well, it's the so-and-so, you say, well, who controls the so-and-so? They say, oh, it's the thingy-me-bob. Well, who controls the thingy-me-bob? And they say, well, it's the what's-its-name. They say, well, who controls the what's-its-name? And then they say, oh, God. And this is the age-old solution to all infinite regresses. It's to stop it, to put some bumpers on the track, and call it God. God is where the book stops, you know? And in fact, that is the metaphysical function of the monotheistic God of the Abrahamic religions. It's like it's the buffers that stop the infinite regress. But I would actually say, well, who controls God? I'm going to be really awkward, who controls God? And I say, well, God controls God. God is self-control. So we have this notion of self-control. Well, does that make any sense? If control, as we've said, requires at least two entities, so God is immediately split into two, into the controlling part and the part that is controlled. Now, you could argue at this point, there is a bit of a way out here, which is to take a bit of a Wittgensteinian line and say, This is the whole thing is the bewitchment of our intelligence by language. And the reason why you can say something like control entails an entity A acting upon at least one other entity B, and power flowing from A to B, so that B's behaviour into the future is determined by A. But of course, what's happened there, taking this Wittgensteinian line, is that this requirement for there to be a doer for the deed of controlling is one that's actually built into the type of language that we speak, the subject predicate Indo-European languages that we speak. And this is an imposition of the underlying and invisible metaphysical structure of our particular language group, and it's a projection of that underlying set of presuppositions onto the world and onto existence. And then in fact self-control isn't like that at all. It isn't about entities at all, you know. But again, I think that dissolves the question again, you know. I mean, that Wittgensteinian approach just simply kind of evaporates the question. It doesn't leave us with an answer, it just says it was a stupid question. You know, so either way, you take the Wittgensteinian line, you end up with the conclusion it's a stupid question. It's a meaningless question because it's not talking about anything real. Except, you know, and it stays locked within the kingdom of Indo-European language. Or you take the kind of line that there is no such thing as a pure entity, especially not in the human psyche. I doubt you can actually really find this centre of will. You can't find it. And so that in a sense, it doesn't dissolve the question in quite the same way. But what it does is, it renders it insoluble. You know, it renders the question insoluble. Are we in control? So either the question is meaningless or insoluble, I would say, given the two best lines that we could take. But nevertheless, in lived experience and in meditation, we will struggle with this. We will struggle with this. Because every day in life, we make things happen. Or we think we do. You know, and we can't throw, if that may or may not be an illusion, but we can't throw it off either way. So I think that's my conclusion, you know, actually, is that are we in control? Well, this is my answer. It's probably a meaningless question. If it's not a meaningless question, it's a question that can't be asked, given the nature of the presuppositions on both of these counts. We're realising that we presuppose stuff when we ask questions. There's baby coots, aren't they? And I think we've got dinner. Another one over. Look at the size of them there.
Yeah. They seem very excited to see us.
They do, yeah. They're lovely, aren't they? And yet, in the completely non-metaphysical realm of our felt lived experience, especially that realm of felt lived experience that surrounds our efforts to meditate, our efforts to pursue the rumour of a beatific state, of the yoga being state, of nirvana, of samadhi. But control is a very real issue, but it's one of which I think existentially isn't really going to be that useful to us except in the most preliminary kind of way. But when push comes to shove, it's about letting be, letting go, opening up, being receptive and giving up that struggle. And again, I would add from the yoga point of view, control entails a split, probably. You know, at least as we're going to understand it in the outset, we're going to try and split ourselves into the controlling part and the controlled part. And yet yoga, the word yoga means wholeness, completeness, reintegration. And yet these control scenarios take us in exactly the wrong direction. They cause it. They split us.
Yeah.
They place us in conflict with ourselves. We can resolve the conflict with ourselves straight away, just by sitting still and dropping it. It's as easy as that. And then you live with what unfolds for the rest of your life. And I promise you, it will be a luminous adventure.
Oh, well, I hope you found that interesting and useful as well. We've nearly come to the end of our walk now. And we'll speak to you soon.
Thanks for listening.